Today's tea drinkers usually have an option of black tea or green tea, sometimes white tea if it's a fancy place, but back in Victorian England, you had the option of beef tea, the ideal beverage for the infirm and convalescing. So thank you to Squarespace for sponsoring this video as we tea some beef, this time on Drinking History. So the first time I ever came across beef tea was when I was researching a video on Civil War hospital food. And it seems that during the 19th century, hospitals made a lot of beef tea. So it has been on my to-do list for quite some time, and some time is here. But as I looked for a recipe to actually make, I was kind of like, these are really, really simple, because basically every recipe is just take beef, put it in water, boil it, and drink the water. That's beef tea. Once in a while, they would put the beef in a jar and submerge that in water and just let the juice kind of concentrate, and then you would dilute it with water to make beef tea. But I finally found a recipe that is ever so slightly more complicated, and it comes from one of Victorian England's celebrity chefs, Alexis Soyer, in his 1851 cookbook, The Modern Housewife or Ménagère. Soyer's new way of making beef tea. Cut a pound of solid beef into very small dice, which put into a stew pan with a small pat of butter, a clove, two button onions, and a salt spoon of salt. Stir the meat round over the fire for a few minutes until it produces a thin gravy. Then add a quart of water and let it simmer at the corner of the fire for half an hour, skimming off every particle of fat. When done, pass through a sieve. I have always had a great objection to passing broth through a cloth, as it frequently quite spoils its flavor. So is it more complicated than all of the other beef tea recipes? Yes, but still pretty simple because it's basically just strained beef broth. So to make it, what you'll need is 1 pound or 450 grams of beef, and you want the least fatty beef that you can find, so there's less skimming. 2 tablespoons of butter, 1 single clove, 2 pearl onions, 1/4 teaspoon of salt, and 1 quart or 1 liter of water. So first cut your beef into, as he says, very small dice, which is where we actually get the term diced, like diced meat or diced vegetables. That's where we get it. Then toss those into a pot along with the butter, the clove, the 2 small onions, and the salt. Then set that over medium heat and let it cook for a couple of minutes as the meat releases its juices. As it mixes with the melting butter, it should come to resemble a very thin gravy, and here you can pour in the water. Let the pot come to a simmer, then reduce the heat so it is just barely simmering and set the lid on and let it simmer for 30 minutes. Now the recipe says that you want to skim off all of the fat as it's simmering. That is easier said than done. I tried, I got some. There is an easier way to do this, which we will get to later on. So let the broth simmer on low for 30 minutes, then remove it from the heat and set up a strainer over a pot and pour the liquid through the strainer. Now, a lot of the recipes from this period have you strain it through a tammy cloth or another type of cloth, and you will get more of the particles out, but Soyer is specific in saying that he finds that that ruins the flavor, so I am just using a mesh strainer. Once strained, you can set it aside to cool, and once it's cooled, it will be easier to skim off the fat. In fact, you can even put it in the refrigerator to speed up that process, and you'll get more of the fat off of the top. And then at this point, you're probably asking, well, what do I do with all that beef that's left over? Well, a lot of writings from the time actually say that it's basically useless at this point because all of the nutrients have been sucked out into the beef tea, so it can be, like, used for dog food or something like that. But that's not true, and a lot of people then knew that's not true. There is still a lot of nutrients left in the beef, so you can actually turn it into like pies, meat pies and stuff like that. Or one recipe from Isabella Beaton, who wrote Victorian England's most popular cookbook, she gives an alternative way to use the leftover meat. And she actually quotes Soyer's recipe. She makes some changes to it, giving us more specifics, like exactly how much butter and stuff to use. But at the end of the recipe, she says the meat left from beef tea may be boiled a little longer and pounded with spices, etc., for potting. It makes a very nice breakfast dish. Potted meat is a way of preserving meat, usually kind of by hashing it or making it very, very small, and then packing it tightly into a jar and pouring fat over it. And once the fat solidifies, it is, in theory, airtight and will preserve it for longer. So if you want to do that, by all means, do so as I tell you a bit more about the history of beef tea. Beef tea, or versions of it by other names, goes at least back to the Renaissance. In Bartolomeo Scappi's 1570 cookbook, he has a section of recipes for the sick, and this included several chicken broths and a couple recipes for veal broth. They were flavored with cinnamon, vinegar, and wine, but essentially, the veal broth is a fancy version of beef tea. But beef tea by that name doesn't really appear until the mid-18th century, and it's kind of a home remedy for all sorts of ills. As my grandpa used to say, it'll cure what ails ya. He didn't say that about beef tea, he said it about other things, but still, same concept. Though it wasn't always as a drink. In 1784, the Scottish physician William Buchan suggested that when a woman is in childbirth, you should give her light food. But when the stomach will not bear any kind of nourishment, the patient may be supported for some time by the clysters of beef tea or chicken water. A clyster being an enema. And it is a little disturbing that this is actually the second time enemas have come up on this program in the last 2 months. If you watch the video on Kellogg's cornflakes, you'll know all about that, and it's even more disturbing. But worry not, I will be drinking this beef tea. Now, just as it was good for women giving birth, it was also good for the baby post-birth. Now, the idea was that a wet nurse would feed the baby with milk. But a nurse who has not milk enough is apt to imagine that this defect may be supplied by giving the child wines, cordial waters, and other strong liquors. This is an egregious mistake. The only thing that has any chance to supply the place of the nurse's milk must be somewhat nearly of the same quality as cow's milk or beef tea with a little bread. It never can be done by the help of strong liquors. I just love that in 1807, liquor was considered even an option by some people to replace mother's milk. I've heard of people saying this gin or whiskey tastes like mother's milk, but I always thought that was an expression. Anyway, by the 19th century, this beef tea had really become the drink to have if you were ill or convalescing at home. Almost all of the cookbooks from this period have at least one recipe for beef tea, often in sections with recipes specifically for invalids. And since, during the 19th century, it seems that everyone was sick all the time, beef tea became a common drink to have in the households of both America, England, and all over Europe. Provided you had the money to produce it, because it took a lot of time, and it took a lot of beef, which was an expensive product. So, beef tea quickly became the ideal candidate for commercial production. Enter the Bavarian chemist Justus von Liebig. He was interested in the chemistry of food. He's the person who emphasized adding nitrogen and minerals to fertilizer, invented one of the first baby formulas, and he is the person that we can thank for spreading around that felonious idea that searing meat locks in the juices. It does not. But in 1840, he came up with a way of extracting the essence from beef, and it took 30 pounds of beef to make 1 pound of beef extract. And in 1865, he established Liebig's Extract of Meat Company in Frei Bentos, Uruguay. Being produced in Uruguay was much less expensive because they had a flourishing leather market, and so beef was simply an inexpensive byproduct of that production. Now, his product was not beef tea, but when it was mixed with water, it would become a substitute for beef tea. But it wasn't just water. It could be mixed with Madeira, sherry, or port wine, or the yolk of a fresh egg, or a trifle of fresh butter, or some bread, or a boiled potato. A slight addition of Worcestershire sauce is liked by many. And it was good at all times of day. It was good for your breakfast, but also it could be added to your soups or sauces and other dishes, or as a nightcap. This beef tea soothes and settles the stomach, allays brain excitement, and induces sleep. And both Liebig's extract of meat and homemade beef tea had big proponents, including Alexis Soyer, whose recipe we're making today, and Florence Nightingale, hero of the Crimean War and founder of modern nursing. But even with big names behind it, beef tea and beef extract did have its detractors. One 1874 article decried the uselessness of beef tea. Chambers Journal says many persons believe that beef tea is very nourishing and is an excellent strengthener for people of weak health. This is a mistake. And in 1865, the New York Times, quoting the Pall Mall Gazette, talked about just how much beef was being wasted in its production. The waste of beef in making beef tea is enormous. 62,000 pounds a year are used in one London hospital alone. At the present price of meat, this is a very serious matter. It is Liebig's theory that in beef tea, properly made, you get all the nutritive part of the beef. The British Medical Journal, on the other hand, asserts that a dog fed on beef tea dies as soon as one who gets nothing but mere water. They go on to suggest that should you really want to get the nutrients of the beef, then after drinking the beef tea, you should eat the remaining beef that's left over, which kind of defeats the purpose, seeing as it's for people who can't digest the solid beef. And they admit that and kind of say, hey, here's another alternative. You could use more wine and less beef tea in fever cases and the like. Wine by itself will support life for a very long time. Wine, by all means, for the sick poor as well as for the sick rich. But the mob had spoken, and it was in favor of beef tea. And with the commercial success of Liebig's extract of meat, there were other companies getting in, trying to capitalize on this new concentrated form of beef. One of the most famous was a Scottish butcher who was living in Canada. He had been given the job of producing a shelf-stable beef extract with which to supply the French army during the Franco-Prussian War. And in 1871, he introduced fluid beef. A brilliant new product with an absolutely horrible name. Fluid beef. Gross. And that's why, when he moved to England in the 1880s, he changed the name to Bovril. Bovril became incredibly popular in the UK at the end of the Victorian era, and was even used by the British Army, who used it in the same way that they used dried meat in their field rations. It was part of the ration in the Second Boer War and in World War I. And while homemade beef tea lost favor in the subsequent years, Bovril continued and continues to be sold in the UK and other parts of the world. Meat extracts aren't so popular today in the US, but they did have their heyday in the early 20th century. They, along with beef tea, are mentioned in Fanny Farmer's Food and Cookery for the Sick and Convalescent, though she says that homemade beef tea is definitely preferable to the commercial extracts that were on the market. And while, like the nurses before her, she does suggest that it can be used for those who are sick, she cautions it is never safe to resort to beef tea as the principal article of diet for more than a few days, as it would mean slow starvation to the patient. One place I did not expect to find beef tea cropping up, but I sure did, was in a cocktail book. Actually, numerous cocktail books of the early 20th century. Like in 1917's The Ideal Bartender, there is a recipe for beef tea made with pepper, salt, and celery salt with a side of ice. Can you imagine going into a bar today and ordering a tall glass of beef tea? No, I don't think you could. Though a lot of those ingredients are actually available for the Bloody Mary, so it's just the beef that you would need. But having beef tea in bars was actually a thing early on, and in the 1960s, Campbell's Soup seems to have tried to bring it back. In the early 1960s, Campbell's came up with an ad campaign for Soup on the Rocks, where you would chill a glass of beef broth and then drink it up. They said you could take it straight or add a dash of Worcestershire or lemon peel for a kicky switch. And with only 16 calories a serving, they said it was ideal for dieters. Then if you wanted something a little more elevated, they advertised the Frisky Sour, the greatest drink since Soup on the Rocks, the brightest, beefiest drink of the year. Mix Campbell's beef broth, 2 cans chilled, 1 can of ice water, 1/3 cup fresh lemon juice. Shake, enjoy. No, I don't think I will. I've never really wanted a cocktail that was known as beefy. And yet, my beef tea should be about ready to drink, so here we go. So once your beef tea has cooled, it's much easier to skim the fat off the top. Then it can be reheated, and it's ready to drink. And here we are. Victorian beef tea. So I put it into this glass just so you could kind of see what it looks like. It is murky, it's not clear. If you put it through a cloth, it would have been clearer. And it's very light in color. If you make it using like beef extract, like Bovril or something, usually it's darker. But this old recipe, light beef tea. Here we go. It smells like beef bouillon. That's actually really nice. That's like, on a cold evening, that would be wonderful to have. I mean, does it taste like tea? No, not at all, because there's no like tea leaves in it. But it also doesn't taste like bouillon or beef stock or something like that. It's much lighter in flavor. It's not really beefy. It's more, I mean, you just get a hint of it. There's like this kind of savoriness, but there's also, it's unctuous, like it coats the tongue, because even though we've skimmed off the fat, there is still fat in there. That's actually really nice. So I don't think that you could just swap this out for like bouillon or something like that. It's not the same, especially if you were making it like with a bouillon cube. It's not the same because there is a texture to this that you're not going to get with any kind of soup product. It is different. And so yeah, that is beef tea. And I'm gonna put that recipe up on the Tasting History website. Also make sure you are signed up for the Tasting History newsletter, which you'll do so by going to tastinghistory.com, a website that I made with help from today's sponsor, Squarespace. Squarespace makes building a website so easy with their dynamic tools like their drag and drop technology for both desktop and mobile. And I do love that the desktop and mobile kind of work together. If you make a change on the desktop, it automatically updates for a mobile view. They also have lots of templates, so if you don't really know what you want or just don't want to start with like a blank page, you can start with a template and make changes as you go. And if you do use your website for business, Squarespace helps you keep in contact with your customers through their email campaign tools, so you can always keep people apprised of new items or when there's a sale. So if you're looking to make a website, go to squarespace.com to get a free trial, and when you're ready to launch, go to squarespace.com/tastinghistory and get 10% off of your first purchase of a website or domain. And I will see you next time on Tasting History.